to Harrismith Radio. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode is about what plants, especially native plants, can teach us about thriving in adversity, an unlikely Japanese garden in Lethbridge, and a BC winery where sacred geometry, a pyramid, and reverence for the earth has nurtured award-winning wines. By the way, if you want to read Harrismith magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harrismith magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. Lyndon Penner is an Alberta-based garden designer, CBC plant pundit, author, and sometimes garden tour guide. One of the gardens he's helped visitors explore is the remarkable Nika Yuko Garden in Lethbridge, Alberta. The authentic Japanese garden, only one of four in Canada, was a centennial project for the good folks of Lethbridge. It celebrates the friendship between Canada and Japan, but because it also substitutes some native Alberta species for the Japanese maples, cherry trees, and other plants native to Japan, it's also a lesson in how to make wise use of native plants and how, sometimes, plants, like people, thrive in adversity. I spoke with Lyndon Penner about that and much more. Here's our conversation.
My name is Lyndon Penner, and I am a gardener and horticultural consultant and landscape designer and sometimes a tour guide.
And when you say sometimes a tour guide, one of the things that you've offered tours for and what you wrote about in the 2020 Almanac for Harrismith is about the Nika Yuko Garden in Lethbridge. And
Correct. That's an
authentic Japanese garden. It's one of the, only four authentic Japanese gardens in Canada. Give people a little sense of what that garden is like and what an authentic Japanese garden is.
Well, in order for a Japanese garden to qualify as an authentic Japanese garden, it needs to be designed by a Japanese person or a Japanese Canadian, somebody with Japanese ancestry. There's very specific principles of Japanese design that have to be followed. So it was designed in the 1960s. It was a centennial project, and it was unheard of at that time for a small Canadian city, especially like Lethbridge. It was quite a bit smaller even than it is today. They paid a landscape architect from Tokyo to come over and design the Japanese garden, and that was totally unprecedented. That had really never been done. It was designed by Dr. Sugimoto, who was a landscape architect who is, from what I understand, actually a friend of the Japanese royal family, and he was an up-and-coming designer at that time. He was in his early 30s. Now he's in his early 80s. He was asked if it was possible to create a Japanese garden, an authentic Japanese garden in a place like Lethbridge, which is dry and cold and windy and a really short growing. And lots of people said, well, you can't do it. And so he said, yes, we can. And he worked with local experts and he worked with local horticulturalists to figure out how do you create the Japanese aesthetic with plants that are suitable for prairie growing conditions. So for example, bamboo was totally out. You are not going to find
no kidding.
Bamboo. Yeah, yeah. You know, in an Alberta garden, they couldn't use azaleas and rhododendrons, which are, you know, very central to Japanese garden design. They couldn't use cherry blossoms. So a lot of substitutes had to be found. So the garden not only had to be beautiful and authentic, it also had to work with the climatic conditions that exist there. So instead of rhododendrons, lilacs were used. And instead of bamboo, they used caragana and dwarf species of willow. And instead of cherry blossoms, flowering crab apples were used. And so it created a feel of Japan without actually using plants that probably you would use if you were in Okinawa or, you know, somewhere in the country. They also used a lot of native plants. In Japan, they would probably use cypress They would probably use false cypress, some of the smaller firs perhaps, and that wasn't really possible. So at Nikkiyuko, they used juniper, one of the native junipers. They used potentilla, which is also a native shrub. They used, you know, a lot of spruce, a lot of pine, some native, some introduced. And of course, even Japanese maples. You know, a Japanese maple would be extremely unhappy living in, you know, somewhere as landlocked as southern Alberta. They are coastal trees by nature. And so the maples that were used in the garden are actually amur maples, which are Chinese, but they had that look, they had that aesthetic. So amur maples are native to northern China, Mongolia, and are used to short hot summers, long cold winters, which is exactly what we have in southern Alberta. And so you wouldn't know that going into the garden that they weren't Japanese maples, because they're fine textured, they have been beautifully sculpted and shaped, but they were chosen to create that look, but also to be able to thrive in the climate they were planted in.
So that's a ton of work to go to create a Japanese garden in Lethbridge. So it raises the question of, why Lethbridge?
Why Lethbridge? That is an excellent question. There actually was a fairly large contingent of Japanese people living in southern Alberta, you know, after the war. And there's different reasons as to why they came there. Lots of Japanese staff in the garden have told me it was because southern Alberta had good soil. It was a good place for farming. So, you know, if you go through like some of the smaller towns around Lethbridge, places like Tabor, some of those places, there's a surprising number of Japanese names in the cemeteries. So after the war, a lot of Japanese people settled in southern Alberta. You know, small towns and cities were being given money in the 1960s for centennial projects. And a lot of towns built hockey rinks, you know, and did things like that, sports places. Southern Alberta had a Japanese community association. There was basically a group whose job it was that they were sort of helping Japanese people become integrated into Canadian society. How do you live and work in, you know, in a new country for a lot of them? And it was also to help Canadians sort of become familiar with Japanese culture. And, you know, there was this great spirit of friendship and camaraderie that, like, one of the Japanese staff who worked in the garden told me once that in the 1940s, Japanese people were actually not allowed in Lethbridge. And by the 1960s, they were opening the Canada-Japan Friendship Garden, which is what the translation of Nikkiyuko is, which is extraordinarily progressive for a 20-year period, you know. And so when the idea came up that there was a centennial project, it was suggested that, you know, we have a large population of Japanese people here. They are a vital and important part of our community. Wouldn't it be lovely if we created a Japanese garden that everyone could enjoy, that it would be for everyone, and that it would represent the ongoing friendship between our two nations.
Now, I want to go back to, because you mentioned that back in the 40s, Japanese people weren't allowed into Lethbridge. So that naturally opens the question of, you know, certainly further west than you in BC during the war, Japanese were interred, right?
Exactly.
It was not a great moment for Canada. It certainly wasn't a great moment for the Japanese in Canada.
Is there a relationship
between that interment and now the embracing of Japanese culture and Japanese people in Western Canada?
Yes. After the internment camps of the Second World War, there was people living in Japanese people living in southern Alberta before the war and after the internment camps, and they were allowed to go home. A lot of them did come west. Like, Japanese people were often viewed with suspicion and apprehension even after the war. And
yep.
There's actually a plaque in the garden honoring a cannery or a factory owner who lived in Lethbridge and owned this business and actually employed Japanese people at a time when nobody was doing that. And there is actually a little stone commemorating him, because he basically ensured that a number of Japanese families had income and were able to actually feed their families and survive. So there is a relation there between those two events. I don't think it's talked about very much. Honestly, it's not a proud moment in our history that we sent Japanese people to these internment camps. It's something that brings me personally great shame, even though I was not alive at that time. And it's important that we don't forget that, and that we don't ever allow that to happen again.
Let's talk a little bit about the challenge of growing the Japanese garden, or growing the plants in the Japanese garden in Lethbridge in the sense of native species, because that's something I know that that's very dear to your heart, is trying
that's
to...
That's my wheelhouse.
Yeah. So let's hang on to that for a second. You love plants, but you really, really love native plants. What's your fascination and passion for native plants? Where does that come from?
It probably comes from the fact that I was a rural farm kid who grew up in Saskatchewan. Plants were expensive, and, you know, we didn't get to go to the nursery all the time to buy perennials. And I noticed as a teenager that a lot of the fancy, expensive perennials from the garden center did not thrive in the way that plants did in the forests, in the ditches, in the meadows, in the marshlands that I found. And I also began to be puzzled by the fact that I can go to a nursery and buy half a dozen kinds of penstemon, and they weren't the same kinds of penstemon that I found out in the countryside. And I went, well, why am I paying money for fancy pants hybrid cultivars that don't really thrive, and yet they are growing in horrifically poor soil in this windy, dry location over here? Why can't I buy that plant? And I was always looking for plants that would thrive, because, you know, what is better suited to the growing conditions that you have than something that actually evolved there? So it started with an appreciation and an admiration of nature. We camped a lot when I was a kid. I never wanted to be in the house. I was always outside. And I would find things like paintbrush or lady slippers or native columbine or, you know, anything like that. And I'd think, why isn't this available at my local nursery? It's obviously hardy. It's very beautiful. I would love to grow this. And so I was probably 12, 13, 14 at this time. I started digging native plants from the wild, which is not a thing that I recommend, and it's not a thing that I would ever advocate people to do. But I think a lot of gardeners have done that, and I was young and I didn't know better, and I didn't have anybody in my life to tell me not to do that. There's a better way. And I would dig
Lyndon, it sounds like you were doing drugs or you know, racing cars down the street. You were just picking native plants. It's okay.
That's
you can
exactly
forgive yourself.
Like one in five kids will experiment with native plants. Then they're gardening on weekends. Then they're starting to hide it from their coworkers and their family. So I would go out and I would dig stuff and I would bring it home, and invariably it would die. And I couldn't figure out how do you move a native plant from the wild? And then I started reading everything I could possibly find out about it. And it was hard here because I could easily buy a field guide or get a book from the library that would tell me what I was looking at. But all of the native plant gardening books in Canada seem to be written either for Vancouver Island or the Toronto area, neither of which was helpful to me. So I started just experimenting, truly, where I was like, well, if it won't live if I dig it out, what if I take a cutting? I know how to do that. Why don't I do that? What if I collected seed and tried germinating it myself? And I started to have success, and it was exciting. And I think that was something that anybody can go to a nursery, right, and buy a peony or a rose or a lily. And you can, you know, go to the library and get books about how to grow them. And it's not difficult, but native plants were secretive and they didn't easily yield their, you know, their mysteries to you. So it was like, well, how do I make this one germinate? Or how do I make that one thrive? Or what is it that this one wants? And it was exciting in a way that, I mean, and not that I didn't love going to the nursery to buy peonies and roses and lilies. I did and still do. But native plants, when you started to sort of unlock their secrets, it was thrilling. And I wanted to share that with people. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to use those in landscape designs. And I wanted, you know, I still want to see boulevards planted with native species. I also liked the fact that they weren't instant gratification, which a lot of gardeners do not like. But native plants on the prairie, a lot of them deal with the dry, the wind, the heat, the drought, by producing enormous root systems. And those roots take time to develop. And so in a lot of cases, when you plant a native prairie plant, there's a lot happening under the surface of the soil while there's very little happening at the top. And this goes on for several years before they really begin to flower and thrive and do well.
Like grasses, for example, right?
Exactly. Exactly. It was, for some reason, like, I have no patience for standing in line at the grocery store or being stuck in traffic, but I can grow a native grass that will take 7 years to look nice, and that doesn't bother me at all. It's weird. But I just found that native plants were not always, but often a little bit finicky, that they took their time, that they were, you know, that there was things going on with native plants that you didn't get with garden center plants, I guess.
Right. So this is when in your teen years. So when I was a teenager, I was a member of the Royal Astronomical Society and the math club in high school. And I was a total nerd. And you're obviously in nerd world as well, right?
Oh, I was a hardcore nerd. Yeah, I didn't get invited to parties. I wasn't cool. I was reading Christopher Lloyd's gardening books and, you know, and P.D. James mystery novels. That was my jam. So no, I was not cool. And I also thought that because I went to high school in a small town and had a very small graduating class, I was like the entire nerd community. So I didn't know that there was other nerds in the world. So it was very exciting for me when I started working in a local nursery and discovered that there was people who cared just as much about plants as I did. And there was people who were really interested in learning about how I'd had success with native plants. And there was people who found it really compelling that I spent my weekends tromping around in the woods looking for interesting stuff. That was a great moment for me when I discovered that, you know, I was not the only nerd in the village. So let's
play with that metaphor a bit, because this struck me as I was reading some background stuff that you've written, that you're fascinated by these native species that can take root in soil and take root in rock and thrive despite the fact that the conditions around them aren't exactly ideal in terms of mm-hmm. other kinds of spas. So that sounds like you in high school, right? Like you're...
Well, thank you. That is a lovely compliment. I always found it strange that there were some plants that seemed to like harsh conditions. There is a beautiful plant in the bean family that is native here called the showy local weed, and it has silver foliage and purple flowers, and it's stunning, and I can grow it, and it's fine, but it never ever looks as good for me as it does when it grows in the cracks beside the highway. That is a form of resilience that is just astounding to me, and I think you actually want to be somewhere that is blistering hot, windy, with super poor soil. Like, that is your ideal growing condition. Or plants that grow at the top of the mountains in the Rockies, where they are in intensely bright sun and horrible soil, and it's windy, and their growing season is like 77 days, and they're unhappy in gardens because they would rather be in that crevice at the top of a mountain. And I just find that extraordinary, that, you know, plants are very much like people, that some of us need some support. Some of us need coddling. Some of us need richer soil than others. And some of us are happy to be out in the wind and the dust and the poor soil, making our own living that way. And it just, plants have different personalities. You know, what an iris wants is not necessarily what a saxifrage wants. Or, you know, there are some lilies that are so easy to grow, and I love them. And there's others that they make me work for it. And that's neat. I think that's really cool. Not all lilies are created equal. There's lots of diversity in plants, even within a genus. You know, like, people think clematis is one thing. There are over 300 species of clematis. You know, like, I could grow a new one every year for the rest of my life, and I would never run out of clematis to grow. You know, plants are the coolest thing.
Let's talk a little bit about people's gardens. How do people start? Where, if people said, yeah, this, you know, like, Lyndon's right. Like, I'm an idiot. Why am I spending a ton of money on these things when I could get, you know, grow something that's actually going to grow in my climate zone?
I always tell people, first, choose a theme. The garden has to serve the gardener. And this is really important, because at the end of winter, Canadians are very hungry for color, and we go to the nursery and we buy everything that is in bloom, and we spend money we don't have on plants we don't need to impress people that we don't like.
So let's come back to the very beginning of this conversation about the Nikkei-Yuko Garden, which had something very profound to say about Japanese people and being welcomed into the Lethbridge area and welcome to Canada. And I want to bring that around to what you, the message you're delivering about native species. And I love the connection you made between species that are thrive in difficult conditions and that it's okay that there are people in the world who thrive in difficult conditions. And I think that's something that we really need to pay attention to.
In Nikkei-Yuko, some plants actually want to be in the more windy and more exposed types of the garden, and some of them prefer to be in the sheltered places. And that's okay. And a garden changes and evolves over time as well. The garden is always in a state of flux, and it always changes. And this is part of the joy and part of the beauty of the Japanese garden. Gardens tell a story. Sometimes we are sheltering in place. Sometimes we are out in the open and the exposed places. But nothing stays the same forever. No part of the garden is static. Everything changes. And the Japanese are very good about welcoming that. Canadians aren't, I find. I find that we don't like change. We don't like when things are different or when things are being done differently than we expect them to be. Gardens just go on and they evolve and they soften and they change, and something that works this year might not work next year. And the Japanese love that. That's part of the experience in the garden, is that the garden is always evolving. We all have to learn too. Sometimes it takes a while to get to that point in your journey.
Well, thanks for taking us on this journey today and telling us the story of the garden, the Japanese garden, and gardens in general and native species in general. So thanks very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Lyndon Penner from his family home in Calgary. Ezra Sipes heads up the second generation that runs the Summerhill Winery in Kelowna, BC. Summerhill produces organic vegan wine and stores it within a wooden pyramid built on the principles of sacred geometry. I chatted with Ezra about his family's reverence for the earth, what it means for its wines, and the lessons of nature. I began, of course, with the pyramid. Tell me a little bit about the pyramid that is on site and how you actually use it to produce the wine that you produce.
We have a four-story pyramid that is our wine cellar. When our wines are finished, they're put in the bottle. They rest in the pyramid for at least a month before we send them out for distribution and to our packing warehouse. And the pyramid was built with sacred geometry. That is the geometry that underpins everything in nature. And it was aligned to the stars, built without metal or electricity on compacted earth.
You're talking about building that without electricity and very organically. And you're also very focused on organic in a variety of ways on the vineyard up in there. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Sure. To my family, growing organically and biodynamically is about our relationship with the earth and our relationship with life itself. We see ourselves as a part of nature and the farm as an ecosystem. And, you know, we see nature as the teacher, as being wise and knowing more than we do. So we're always looking at organic and biodynamic systems rather than what are called conventional ones.
So tell me a bit about biodynamic. How does that differentiate from organic, and how do you make use of biodynamic techniques in the winery?
Biodynamics is actually the world's first organic certification, and organics is something that grew out of biodynamics. It does have a spiritual dimension to it. When we grow biodynamically, we make all of our fertilizers and inputs for disease control on site from traditional European herbal medicines and from cow manures and from whatever is available, really. So we have, you know, our neighbors have horse barns and all that stuff, and we collect all that stuff for our fertility program. When we make wine biodynamically, it means that the wine is a real product of nature. All of the nutrients to have a successful fermentation have to be there in the grapes themselves. You don't add the nutrients. You got to grow the grapes right. And even the yeasts are not the freeze-dried ones that you buy from a lab, but they're the yeasts that naturally live in our farm and in our cellar.
And you're also producing wine that is vegan. And when I first read about that, I thought, well, you know, what would not be vegan about wine? So can you fill me in a bit about that?
Well, there are animal byproducts that are used commonly in winemaking as fining agents. we're a northern climate growing wine in British Columbia. So red wines especially tend to be tannic and acidic. And if you find them with milk products or eggs or isinglass, which is bladders from sturgeon, it can sort of soften those wines and make them more palatable at a younger age. And we eschew that. We typically, if we have a red wine that's a little edgy, we just age it for longer. We let it rest in the barrel and let time and oxygen bring the harmony to the wine.
Tell me a little bit about the spiritual or religious piece that seems to be sort of an undertone, a continuo for what you're doing in terms of the respect for the land and respect for the produce that you're producing.
Well, this is a gift that my parents gave to me and my brothers, and it's a worldview of life as a sacred and as a gift, and our time here on earth as you know, something to use, not just to make money or have status, but to have a meaningful life and having a connection with community and with the planet. Those are things that bring meaning to life. And so that's what we do.
Great. And that's rewarded you well in terms of, and it sounds like it's not something that you particularly care about, but you've won, the wine has won lots of awards over the years, right?
The most beautiful thing about this way of making wines is it's holistically a great way to do it, not only for the people who work on the farm and for the land itself, but also because, you know, in wine we talk about terroir, right? The notion that wine expresses the land. And when you grow wine this way, the grapes have a real connection to the land. They have deep roots, they have their own immune system, and this is how you make the most beautiful, unique wines with a real sense of terroir.
So what's going to happen? You said you were second generation. You're in your 30s now. Is there a third generation coming along? What's the plan there?
Yeah, we all have children. Me and all my brothers have children. And we'll see how it goes. No pressure, but my daughter is 13 now, and we always have her sip and starting to develop her palate and appreciation for the beautiful things that we do.
Well, thanks very much for sharing the story of the winery. I do hope that sometime in the future on the podcast we'll come back and talk longer. There's so much, as I said, so much there to unpack about what you're doing, and it's a real inspiration to talk to you about how you are in praise of the earth and respect the earth.
Thank you so much, Wayne. Thank you so much.
That was Ezra Sipes, Getting Better with Age in Kelowna, B.C. So here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple iTunes or in your favorite podcast player. And please tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.